Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. I'm your host, Ron Edwards, coming to you on a wintry Tuesday evening, Wednesday evening here in the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. For those that celebrate Thanksgiving and are preparing for the annual dinner and with loved ones and friends and et cetera, we wish you the very best, if you will. A lot going on in the country today. Our associate, Mr. Allen, will not be with us again this evening. He is tied up with some previous commitments that may take him away over the next additional program weeks, if you will. But tonight's program, we made somewhat of a change because of a very interesting piece on the CBS affiliate here in the Twin Cities, WCCO Channel 4, and longtime reporter and anchor Angela Davis, interviewing one of the great legends, if you will, of sports and civic activity here in the Twin Cities, Floyd Smallard. Smallard, raised in the city of St. Paul, one of the greatest athletes ever to come out of that city, one of the greatest athletes to come out of the state of Minnesota, attended college at Arkansas A&M, if you will, and then for many years was the most successful and winningest coach at at St. Paul Central. We also have a Central, or used to have a Central here in the city of Minneapolis. Mr. Smallard, who will be, by the way, for his friends and many friends, be celebrating his 80th birthday this coming Saturday in downtown St. Paul. We wish him the very best. We're hoping to be able to be in attendance. We have some previous commitments, but we've known Floyd for many, many, many years. We played semi-pro football together in the very early 1960s, if you will. He is just a great human being, he and his lovely wife, Lorraine, and their family. But it was the topic that I think really caught my attention and provided a certain level of emotion, because Mr. Smallard and his family had coordinated a significant piece of Minnesota history in behalf of a man who passed from this life on the 30th of October, the legendary and also one of the greatest athletes and football players, basketball and track in the history of the state of Minnesota, Bob Blakely. As we said just seconds ago, Mr. Blakely passed from this life on October the 30th, if you will, at age 78, if I'm not mistaken. Just a great human being. I also had the pleasure, along with Mr. Smallard, of playing semi-pro ball. That was before the Vikings and before the Minnesota Twins. It was when the Twin Cities were, quote-unquote, a backwater town as it pertains to professional sports, if you will. We played for a championship team in the old North Central League, semi-pro football league, consisting of teams in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Rochester, Minnesota, Green Bay, if you will, even though Green Bay had a legitimate professional team, the Green Bay Packers. There was a semi-pro team there, Eau Claire, Wisconsin, Mason City, Iowa, et cetera. Those were the interesting days. Those were the days when you were not overwhelmed with a lot of sports on television because there were only a couple of networks. There was no cable, buddy. And you got your television where you could get it. In fact, in some locations back in those days, 1959, 60, 61, television would actually go off at 1 and 2 o'clock at night and come back on at 6. Those were the days. Of course, hopefully those are not the days that Donald Trump and others are talking about returning to the good old days. Because in that period of time, 1960, 61, 1959, and et cetera. We still, in many parts of the United States, south of the Mason-Dixon line, we could not drink out of the same water faucets. We couldn't go to the same laboratories. We couldn't go to school with, quote-unquote, our white counterparts, and et cetera. America was a segregated and a very angry nation, as it is a very angry nation as of tonight. But for the purposes of the first 15 or 16 minutes of tonight's program, we want to concentrate on Bob Blakely, one of the greatest, as we said, all-state, a consensus high school All-American while at St. Paul Central, actually having joined his brother. I well remember their last year playing together, the 1954 season. Bob Blakely, who was junior to his brother, Dickie Blakely, two of the greatest pair, quote-unquote, of athletes in the history, again, in the history of the state of Minnesota. The reason we go to great lengths tonight to talk in terms of the length, if you will, and the dynamics of the individuals is because we African-Americans here in the state of Minnesota do not have a history museum, if you will. In fact, it is extremely difficult. And for those that have listened to this program, the Ron and Don program, I have been certainly a consistent critic of the fact that over $3 million was raised by the community to dedicate and operate a African museum. The money disappeared, never to be accounted for, if you will, and consequently, the African-American community in Minnesota was shortchanged drastically. And so it means that the rich history of the sons and daughters of the African is unknown. Probably to 90%, I repeat that again, to 90% of the African-American population in the state of Minnesota, and it's shrinking each and every year. In fact, absent a historical museum, within 5 years, probably 97 to 98% of African-Americans in the state of Minnesota will have not a clue about their history, about the contributions, if you will, the dedication, the significant positive, if you will, of the sons and daughters of the African. And so watching Mr. Smollett being interviewed by Angela Davis on CCO on the 6 o'clock news here in the Twin Cities was very refreshing. It was very emotional, but it was very appreciative. In fact, we made it a point to call our friend Mr. Smollett and to thank him for putting together, really, and encouraging WCCL-TV to do this piece on the late Bob Blakely. As we said, his brother, Dickie Blakely, also one of the greatest football players and et cetera. And it was quite an occasion to see them in the 1954 season playing together at St. Paul Marshall, which was a high school in those days, if you will. Actually, was about six blocks away from Central High School in St. Paul. But it was not until that particular period of time that Negroes were allowed to go to St. Paul Central. Basically, the Negro population of the so-called Rondo-Dale neighborhood, if you will, which was ultimately bastardized by the freeway and urban renewal and et cetera, that Negroes went to basically two high schools, Mechanic Arts and, of course, Marshall High School. And so it again was with great appreciation to see the pictures, because there was another piece of history that many of us remember, and we remember the proudness that we felt when it was announced in 1955 that the legendary, the great Bob Blakely, had been elected by students of St. Paul Central as the homecoming king. And I got to tell y'all, is that that was unheard of. In fact, the Jet magazine back then carried a nice picture in that section of Jet Magazine. Probably a lot of you don't even know about Jet Magazine. And which it talked about events, current events. And there was a picture of Bob Blakely and his white, quote-unquote, queen, the homecoming queen, the homecoming king. And at that particular time, St. Paul Central was about 92% white, if you will. But that's how endeared and how loved and respected Bob Blakely was with the student body. He later went on to play at the University of Minnesota, actually the third, Raymond Presley, Ben Zachary, and then Bob Blakely. Only the third Negro in what we call modern times to play for the University of Minnesota. Prior to the 1953 season, the last time that Negroes had played football at the University of Minnesota was the 1937-38-39 season with three African-Americans, Horace and one other young African-American who had come here from Texas, if you will. That took us back to that period in 1936 and 37 when the deceased William McMoore, Ellsworth Harpo Jr., if you will, and Bert Lewis, whose sons later became all-city and all-state football and track stars here in the state of Minnesota. The great and legendary Bert Lewis, as we said, Ellsworth Harpo Jr., and William McMoore. Years later, to join with the legendary Earl Bowman and others. Again, history that has been lost, history that is not known. As Mr. Smollett pointed out tonight in the interview with Angela Davis of WCCO, that at one point in his junior year, Bob Blakely, and Bob was actually small in stature. I mean, when you talk in terms of when you think about an individual that is throwing the discus and the shot put, you would imagine that person to be around 6'3", 240, 50 pounds. Nowadays, 330, 340 pounds. But Bob Blakely was about 5'11", about 190 pounds, if you will. Fast, powerful. He reminded us of a little smaller version of the legendary and great Jim Brown of my alma mater, the University of Syracuse, if you will. But in the Twin City game, which used to be the game, as Mr. Smollett pointed out this evening, St. Paul Central played the undefeated and mythical, quote-unquote, state champion, Washburn, powerful, powerful team, as big as any small college team, if you will. I remember they had a white halfback by the name of Sundin at 6'4", 215 pounds. They had a gentleman by the name of John Spolam, about 6', 210 pounds. This is Minneapolis Washburn back then. Their line offensively, defensively, this is high school, by the way, averaging about 225 pounds across the front, et cetera. They were going into the game with St. Paul Central and led by Bob Blakely. They were 22-point favorites, if you will. In other words, they were just going to beat St. Paul Central into the ground. Well, it was one of the greatest games ever played. In fact, it's, again, another occasion, another historical event that is not talked about. I was glad to see Mr. Smollett talk about it on camera and talk about it with such conciseness, if you will, detail and specificity, if you will. Because Bob Blakely scored all 26 points in that game as St. Paul Central defeated Minneapolis Washburn 26-7 at Memorial Stadium, the old Memorial Stadium. And I can remember us young brothers there screaming and hollering and pumped up and et cetera, because it continued to be a great moment in the great movement of the Negro, the African-American, finally beginning to be recognized once again Although there had always been a rich history, state of Minnesota, with respect to black athletes, but you would not know it. Let me give you another example for our listening audience across the nation and internationally. In 1921, in Duluth, Minnesota, which at that time had a population of about 2,100 African Americans, a population overall of about 101,000 population then. This was before the race riots and the lynchings. Three African Americans pulled out of a jail there on false charges of rape by a white woman, if you will, and mutilated and hung from the light post there in front of the St. Louis County Jail there in Duluth, Minnesota. But the year before, a African American, a tremendous athlete out of Duluth East, by the name of Estes, had won the 100-220 sprint championship in the state of Minnesota and had led his Duluth East football team to the quote-unquote city championship and et cetera. All of these things, significant history. And I remember about 12 years ago, Dr. Moppins at the University of Minnesota, Duluth, UMD, found some pictures in the library there in Duluth of this young, great African-American athlete, if you will, champion, if you will, in his track uniform and et cetera. The Duluth Herald newspaper, the major newspaper in Duluth, ran those pictures. These were things that we were talking about even then, in 1954, 55, 56, as Dick and Bob Blakely and the great Floyd Smollard and Ransom and Art Frontier, one of the great, this was interesting because you don't hear anything about this either, one of the greatest Hispanic, Mexican, Latinos, et cetera, ever to come out of St. Paul. A defensive end in football, a forward in basketball, played with the legendary, as we said, Floyd Smollard, John Ransom, and John Garrett in a sensational and very powerful team, which actually that particular year, 1955, lost to St. Paul Central and the powerful Bob Blakely by a 6-0 score. So that shows you how powerful those two entities were. All of these African-Americans growing up together in the small area there in St. Paul, if you will, some got opportunities to maybe go to smaller colleges and et cetera. As we said, Bob Blakely later went to the University of Minnesota and became, as we said, only the third Negro since 1939 to play and start at the University of Minnesota. He later went on to play in the Canadian Football League and later joined the old American Football League that later merged to become, quote-unquote, the National Football League. Bob played for the Denver Broncos of the American Football League. All of these memories came back this evening as I watched Floyd Smollard, longtime coach at St. Paul Central, a legend, a man who for many years held track records in the low and high hurdles and the 220, if you will. Just a tremendous athlete, a all-conference quarterback at Arkansas, A-M-N-N, if you will, returned here and took a position in the St. Paul public school system. And as we said, became a great educator, number one, and a great coach, a great member of his community, one of the founders of Rondo Day in St. Paul, if you will, and as a man, as we said, who is preparing to celebrate his 80th birthday at a occasion, a party, a birthday party, and et cetera, at Mars in downtown St. Paul. Some will say, well, what is the relevance of this? We don't need to know this and et cetera. Yes, you do. You always need to know your history. You need to have an understanding of who you were, who your people were, who your race was, what it is that you achieved, what it is you should have been able to continue to achieve if there had not been obstruction and oppression, if you will, and blockage and et cetera. For those of you that are computer persons prone to liking to try to call information up, feel free to call it up with the names that we, some of the names we have just given you. Floyd Smaller, Mechanic Arts, coach at St. Paul Central, Bob Blakely, Dick Blakely, brothers, St. Paul Marshall High School, St. Paul Central, if you will. Earl Bowman, Minneapolis Central, if you will. Bill McMoore, Minneapolis South, if you will. Richard Green, former superintendent of the Minneapolis Public School System, who died at a very early age from an asthmatic attack, while chancellor of the New York City Public Schools, if you will. Richard Robinson, former All-State great, had later become coach there, coach at Minneapolis North. Both of them little All-Americans at Augsburg College here in the city of Minneapolis, at Lutheran College, and doing the from 1956 to 1959, little All-American guards in basketball, and All-Conference and honorable mention little All-American as football halfbacks and et cetera. Yes, yes, Richard Robinson and Dr. Richard Green, who later became superintendent of the Minneapolis Public School System. Even in the situation of Dr. Green and Richard Robinson, the history has already been clouded. The average person, probably 70%, 75% of the population of African Americans, have no idea who these two great men were. William Shorty Patterson, legend, if you will, little All-American at Gustavus Adolphus in southern Minnesota, one of the great Lutheran colleges, if you will. Consensus High School All-American at Minneapolis North, held many, many, many of the scoring records and rebounding records. A giant, a gentle giant of a man, who later spent all of his adult life as director and coordinator and et cetera for the YMCA of Minneapolis. William Shorty Patterson, 6'9", 270 pounds, and could have played for the Minneapolis Lakers if he would have chose to, but he wanted to spend his time and develop a future for his family. They weren't paying a lot of money in professional football back then, and in fact, initially when Shorty came out of Gustavus Adolphus, the NBA, the National Basketball Association, was just starting to integrate, if you will. See, for all those folks that love watching our brothers up and down the courts of the NBA and the NFL and et cetera, many of you don't know your history with regards to how tough it was to break the colored barrier. In fact, at one point in time, from 1933 to 1946, Negroes were not allowed to play in the National Football League, and if it had not been for a man by the name of Paul Brown, later the founder of the Cleveland Browns and then later the owner and coach of the Cincinnati Bengals of the National Football League, we probably would not have gotten back into professional football probably for another 10 or 12 years, if you will. All of this history, but all of it was a part of what was the driving force of young Negroes, young African-Americans across this country in that period right after the Second World War. And it is important, certainly, to those of us of my generation, if you will, when we hear, quote-unquote, pronouncements, if you will, recollections, if you will, and the proper respect of those that long came before us and did the many things that they did to open the door. And I'm talking about myself as a young Negro in 1954 and 55. and I think in terms of when I was asked to take over the position of quarterback at my high school, Minneapolis Vocational, in the 1956 season, I knew there was a piece of history. I had no idea of how important it was until later on. Black men, historians who I respected, made me understand that in my case, as a single young Negro playing quarterback for Minneapolis Vocational in 1956, that I had become the first Negro in the history of the Minneapolis City Football Conference, 11 schools in those days, to ever be allowed to play quarterback for a high school team in the state of Minnesota. And I have a great appreciation now, many, many, many years later, of that historical significance, if you will. In fact, in closing on the personal note, and I normally try to stay away from these kinds of reflections, there was an article, I'll never forget, in late August of 1956, which showed me, we used to always talk about Johnny Blue Jack and et cetera, because we didn't really have many Negro quarterbacks, athletes to make reference to, standing with the ball in my hand and et cetera. And the story in the 1956 edition was Edwards ready to make history. And, even then, as a 17-year-old young Negro, I really didn't have a total appreciation of the barriers that I was breaking. And so that whole group of us in Minneapolis and St. Paul, if you will, young men of significant ability and et cetera, who had a fierce, and see, this was what was important. We had a fierce, fierce desire. We had an anger within us, but because of our elders, be they relatives or be they mentors, we knew how to control that anger by and large, and we knew who to take it out on, if you will. And in closing, I can well remember the 1955 season. Again, this is history. When our football team at Minneapolis Vocational, that 9 of the 11 starters on the football team were Negroes, African-Americans, black, if you will. And I can well remember how we all felt on that defensive unit about the fact that what we had done. And one of the reasons we were all at Minneapolis Vocational, because we knew there was a policy at Minneapolis North in 1955 and 4 and 3 and 2 that only one Negro could start in a sport. And again, for those of you that still know your history and can remember, it's one of the reasons that great legends like Edgar Jackson and Julius Sookie Andrews, again, two of the finest athletes, personnel and members and et cetera, never got a real chance at Minneapolis North because there was a quota system. There were restrictions. There was redlining. In fact, in closing, the late Cecil Newman, founder of the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder, known then as the Minneapolis Spokesman Recorder, St. Paul Recorder, if you will, wrote an editorial with Edgar Jackson, who in the opening game of the season had returned the opening kickoff 104 yards for a touchdown, was benched because his coach, Rube Johnson, a white man, had made the statement that he didn't like the jitterbugging that Edgar Jackson was doing in returning the kickoff and as he went down the sideline. Jitterbugging in those days, we're talking again 1954, jitterbugging was a code word for Negroes and for race and for animus and for just the hatred of the success of the African American. But again, as we move into the final half hour of tonight's program, my great appreciation to Floyd Smollard and to his family for their remembrance of one of the greatest athletes, one of the greatest human beings in the history of the state of Minnesota, Bob Blakely of St. Paul Central, homecoming king, but more importantly, one of the great athletes and, again, one of the great human beings of all time. Well, as we move into the last half hour of tonight's program, again, associate, Mr. Allen, is carrying out other responsibilities and duties, and we'll probably be doing it over the next number of Wednesdays, if you will. And so by and large, we will be keeping the program up and running, if you will, but we will not be taking calls, though there are a group of individuals who are able to text yours truly, and if there are certain questions that are imperative to be responded to, asked, or et cetera, we will do that. But we basically have, in the last 29 minutes, a set agenda. First of all, a very dangerous series of events have taken place. We should not be surprised as the African-American community. I don't know why the white community seems to be surprised, though I know that there are more people scared out there than they want to confess to. A fifth police officer shot and killed in Michigan early this morning. Again, of course, we are broadcasting on a Wednesday. Past weekend, if you will, and then with the culmination, the tragic culmination of a police officer being shot and killed on the campus of Wayne State. He, in fact, was a police officer for Wayne State University there in Detroit, if you will. Shot and killed by an African-American who has been apprehended, if you will. And this came on a very bloody Sunday and Saturday this past weekend here in the United States, with police officers being shot in Kansas City, or outside of Kansas City, in Gladstone, St. Louis, if you will, of course, San Antonio, and our longtime friend and former chief of police here in the Twin Cities 10 years ago, William McManus, the chief of the San Antonio Police Department. Of course, our condolences went out to him from African-American law enforcement here in the Twin Cities. But you had that shooting. You had another shooting. You had a shooting in Florida, if you will. And you had additional shootings actually in California and Tennessee, Ohio. I mean, it is just, it is clear that there is a very volatile backlash taking place to the conditions that have generated themselves in the United States of America. And that is how we move into the remainder of tonight's program. Donald Trump has finally gotten around to appointing a couple of women to his cabinet, if you will, one as the ambassador to the United Nations, the other one to become Secretary of Education. The former she will become former governor of the state of South Carolina, will take on the responsibility as the United States ambassador to the United Nations. She, though, is of East Indian extraction, if you will, and her parents are coming from India, if you will. Haley being a progressive governor, if you will, Republican governor of the state of South Carolina, and was very much involved after the brutal massacre of 9 African-Americans at an African-American church in Charleston, South Carolina. The governor was very much responsible in initiating, upon the demands of progressive forces in the state of South Carolina, to finally take down the Confederate flag, which represents nothing but treason, if you will. You know, I've been fascinated by the infatuation with so many who are part of the traitorous actions and conditions of the so-called Confederacy, if you will. It has always amazed me at how Southerners and sympathizers to treason, if you will, try to justify the terrorist acts, the treasonable acts of those who call themselves the sons and daughters of the Confederacy, if you will. But it explains the easiness in which this country eases in to the kind of narratives that represent the anger and the hostility of this nation based on race. And it is somewhat disturbing, but it should not be surprising to those of us who are the sons and daughters of the African. Now, by the way, earlier today, which will be covered up, as was the $25 million settlement by President-elect Donald Trump, as has been said about President-elect, this man is extremely gifted, as well as his supporters and strategists and tacticians and et cetera, including one of the most vile and dangerous neo-Nazis in the United States, who now serves as chief strategist and tactician for President-elect Donald Trump. It is amazing that people pretended to be shocked this past weekend when the Aryan Nation came together in Washington, D.C. for allegedly their annual meeting, and about, I don't know, 250, 300 of them in a convention hall. And after a very clever and glib neo-Nazi talked in terms of America is for white people, and et cetera. See, I'm always amazed because I saw Donald Trump make the same mistake a number of months ago. We talked about it on this program. I talked about it on my television program and in my column, and et cetera, when Donald Trump was asked about David Duke, one of the most dangerous neo-Nazis, along with the man who now sits at the, well, the left hand of the president-elect of the United States. When I was always fascinated by that, when Donald Trump was asked about the Ku Klux Klan, white supremacists, and such, he said he didn't know anything about it. In fact, for the purposes of authenticating, if you will, we wrote in our column in the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder a column, a specific column, in which we said that that had to be one of the most dangerous signs with regards to a man that is reshaping history, who very well could become president of the United States of America, which he now is, pure and simple. Now, there is some reason to believe that by the time that this program airs again next Wednesday, we will have at least one African-American. Ben Carson, the world-renowned surgeon and et cetera, will possibly be the Secretary of Housing, or Secretary of HUD and Urban Development. We are not totally sure, but we know that powerful, powerful industrial sources, corporate sources, and et cetera, have began to whisper to Donald, who, as we've said on our television programs and et cetera, is himself just getting over the fact that he won. If there was ever a man, and I think you saw it in his meeting with President Barack Obama, if there was ever a scene, as he sat there with President Obama in the Rose Room or wherever it was they were sitting in the White House, who really was trying to understand the fog that surrounded him, I'm talking about President-elect Donald Trump, that he was saying to himself, even as he looked in the face of this black man who happened to be the 44th president of the United States of America, Barack Obama, said, "What the heck am I doing here? How in the hell did I get here?" That was the expression on Donald Trump's face. But on the serious note that we must maintain as an endangered species, oh, let me say to you, my friend, in the remaining 20 minutes of this program, if you will, for those of you out there who do not think that the African American is an endangered species, then you are either a total quisling and a sellout, or you are as great an idiot with regards to what is happening around you than anything that anybody could create on God's green earth, if you will. We have said on our television programs, and we have mentioned strategically on this program, that there is now preparation, and you should see it as you watch the individuals that President-elect Trump is putting into position to carry out the public safety mechanism that must now be in place, that it is clear that we are closer than many of you think with regards to the initiation of quarantine zones in the United States of America for the quote-unquote Negro, Black, or whatever problem that one refers to it in their more private moments, if you will. I repeat again, we are an extremely endangered species. One of the things that you can begin to look for in the next 6 months after the swearing-in on the 20th day of January 2017 of Donald Trump, if you will, a man who is already being referred to by quote-unquote white terrorists, white fanatics, and et cetera, by the identification tag of Hail Trump, if you will. We, by and large, have not heard the reference to Hail. You know, that's when you hold that hand out with that Nazi salute. We have not heard that the level of danger since the emergence from the hall in Munich, Germany, in the late 1920s of Adolf Hitler, the little corporal, if you will. But Donald Trump has positioned and has put in place one of the most dangerous contingency of individuals who have nothing but hatred and disdain for people of color, be they Hispanic, Latino, Asians, and et cetera. And clearly, we know that they have nothing but hatred and disdain for African Americans. Now, let me say this to you for the purposes of tonight's program. The only thing that may, as it pertains to a global power, stand between us and total genocide is the presence of a quote-unquote powerful military and nuclear power, China, if you will. If it were not at this very moment for the existence of China, that's not to say that the Chinese, as a part of their foreign policy, would have any necessary interest or concern one way or the other with the quote-unquote demise of the black population in the United States. But there are other factors that would cause ripples, if you will, to flow through a number of nations of color on the face of the planet. The reason we say this and the genesis for this reflection, these reflections are well thought out, if you will, is the existence, if you will, of a series of doctrines that are already emerging about the wealth of black Africa and the plan afoot to continue to poison, I mean literally poison, the general population of black Africa, particularly anything south of the Sahara. And we do not want to face up, we here in black America, really do not want to face up to the fact of how close we are to genocide, if you will. In fact, if the right-wing extremists that are now moving into total and absolute control of not only the White House, but the Supreme Court, but most importantly and most fatally for us as African Americans, the Constitution of the United States, they would be rounding us up right now. I know that some of you sitting out there are saying that that's ridiculous. This man must be off his rocker. How can he make these kinds of statements and et cetera? These white folks love us. No, they don't. They have nothing but disdain for us, and it's just a point in time of how their numbers can grow and how they can go about the business of beginning to put us away. Now, I also remind you, for those of you that think that it's an impossibility, do yourself a favor. Go back and take a look at history and take a look at those events following the attack on Pearl Harbor and Wake Island and Midway and the Philippines and Indonesia and Malaysia and et cetera. You look at the immediate actions in this country to imprison the entire Japanese-American population of the United States of America. And in fact, the only way from that period of basically February 1st, 1942 to April, May of 1945 as the end of the conflict with quote-unquote in the Pacific began to come to an end with those young Japanese or Nishi Americans who volunteered to fight in the Great War. Now, you have to remember that the young Japanese, American-born, many of them American-born, who were being told they were traitors, but that their lifeblood was needed to help the United States fight the two-front war, because the United States was fighting both in Europe and in the Pacific. And so a young Japanese-American who would volunteer for military service and hope for better conditions for his family interned in some concentration camp in some desolate place, including Minnesota, for all of you bleeding heart liberals who wring their hands in terms of that we are above the pale, if you will. You had a concentration camp right down there on the Minnesota River by a town called Savage, Minnesota. That's an interesting name too, isn't it? And so for those of you that really constitutional rights are stripped from you, and I got to tell you, my brothers and sisters, it is already in play, that you find yourself without any constitutional legal protection, you take a look at what happened and how quickly it happened and how an individual was used who later became, quote-unquote, a bright star, quote-unquote, of liberalism in the United States of America. His name was Earl Warren, later to become Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, presided over Brown versus Topeka, if you will. And in his final years, in his memoirs and et cetera, talked in terms of how he regretted his role. What was his role? Is that after the Japanese bombing, a quote-unquote sneak attack, it was not a sneak attack, by the way, of American military positions, American military bases, assets, and et cetera, that he was immediately appointed by Franklin Delano Roosevelt, one of the most liberal presidents and a Democrat, if you will, and a man who saved America from depression, oops, just as Barack Obama did in 2009 to 2016. But Earl Warren was appointed martial law administrator for actually all of the United States, but particularly the West Coast, because the hysteria, as they were always referred to, were about to land on the sacred shores. Now, the American intelligence community, military, and civilian already knew the Japanese did not have the capacity militarily and had actually already extended themselves. That's the reason that they were not able to put any troops ashore at Hawaii. Again, go back and take a look at your history. Also, many of Japan's military and civilian leaders were actually against an attack upon the United States of America because they maintained they knew that they did not have the industrial capacity, in other words, the ability to make planes, tanks, ships, and et cetera, nor did they have the necessary manpower, personnel power, people power, to carry out a conflict of long duration, if you will. But they clearly knew that they did not have the ability to take military control of the Hawaiian Islands, if you will, and they certainly could not put combat units ashore along the west coast of the United States of America. But Earl Warren, who was a brilliant legal man, former governor of the state of California, et cetera, knew that this was an opportunity to take a concentrated action against the Japanese as well as seize all of their assets. When I say all of their assets, I'm talking about their bank accounts, their businesses, those things that are extremely important to the people being able to survive. And by the way, there have never been any reparations really for the Japanese or the Nishi Americans that even comes close to matching the amount of assets, dollars, and wealth that were taken from them illegally by an act that was clearly in violation of the Constitution of the United States. I always remind my African-American brothers and sisters that the logic and rationale that drives a society is predicated and based upon precedent. this country has shown a precedent. It started when it embraced the doctrine of slavery, and then when it embraced the proposition of segregation, if you will, and nullification by race and et cetera. The precedent, legal and otherwise, has always been in place, and it has always been used against people of color. Now, on that particular note, as we come down to the last 7 minutes, 8 minutes of tonight's program, one of the discussions that is going on around the world, particularly amongst 1.7 billion Muslims, is they have finally realized something that we began to talk about almost 10 years ago on our programs and et cetera, that with the exception of a brief conflict with Serbia in the 1990s under the Clinton administration, this country does not involve itself in the killing in significant and mass numbers of anybody but people of color. Now, that takes us back to my statement and reflection just a short time ago on this program about at this particular point, only the Chinese and their military might and their nuclear power stand between us, we black Americans, and immediate genocide and some quote-unquote delay and proper consideration. When you have people like General Flynn and Mad Dog, as he is referred to, Mata, and when you have particular people like Giuliani and et cetera, who cannot wait to initiate the kinds of actions and programs that will begin to bring a total demise and push us, the African American, the sons and daughters of the African, back to a time before 1863. This is a dangerous time. A very dangerous time for the sons and daughters of the African. Do we have the capability? I'm not sure, particularly when one of the plans, as we said just a number of minutes ago, for effect, is to begin to provide a significant amount of additional drugs into the African American community. Now, the infusion of the epidemic of drugs, and by the way, the DEA 12 days ago, under the Obama administration, one of the last acts that President Obama knew that he had to make was that there has been a serious, serious spike within the American population, with, of course, African Americans disproportionately being the victims of this drug epidemic and et cetera. The drugs, they are guaranteed to weaken the very fiber and the very foundation of a people and of a quote-unquote nation of color, if you will, both psychologically, mentally, with that psychological piece, if you will, but also health-wise. With the decision being made to reduce significantly, though they're not quite ready to make the move on Obamacare because big white corporate Health America has indicated that that would cause a significant deficiency in profits for America's medical institutions, societies, and, of course, would affect the stock market, if you will. But the fact of the matter is that the plan is afoot for the introduction of significant amounts of drugs into the African-American community beyond, my friend, what is in play right now as we speak on this program tonight. I repeat again for the sixth or seventh time, we, the sons and daughters of the African American, are an endangered species. Plan is afoot for our demise, a significant demise. Have you ever thought, I know that many women of color, particularly African American women, mothers and et cetera, have always wondered why we've never really had the kind of debate and discussion, particularly with the health community, about why it is that we are the most prone nation on the face of this earth with all of our technology and medical health facilities and et cetera, on why infant mortality is at such a significant level and high as it pertains to the death of black babies. You pay no attention to that, my friends. And there is certainly a reason for that, because we do not have, nor will we ever be allowed to have, the kind of institutions of communication which allow us, quote unquote, to debate and to discuss these kinds of circumstances, threats, and et cetera, without having white control, if you will. We said to our listening audience a couple weeks ago that I found it fascinating that the panels had grown on all of the cable stations and et cetera, panels that normally were no more than the commentator and two guests, had become like 8, 9, 10 people. But the percentage of African Americans who were allowed to be on this panel, the percentage was always the same. If you had a panel of 9, you maybe got 2 African Americans, no more than 2. So it meant the percentage was always the same, but the system, you are there, quote unquote, to defend your situation and ask necessary questions. No, you're not. And so as we come to the last minute and a half of tonight's program, we find it imperative that we are blessed with at least having some kind of platform to speak beyond just standing on the street corner in front of the liquor store or the grocery store or wherever, to talk amongst ourselves beyond 2 or 3 or 4. I cannot impress upon you tonight, my friend, based on the appointments that have been made, the strategies that are going on, the kinds of discussions that are happening, but at the same time, the backlash that is taking place, where there are African Americans independent of any kind of waiting on some structured kind of plan and action, are taking action and things and matters into their own hands because they have lost all sense of hope that there will be anything different. That is a sad conclusion, my friend. It is one that we should not wish upon ourselves or our future, if we have one, as a species of the human race in this country. But the fact of the matter is, we are not doing anything to protect our future or to protect that which is the most important aspect of our future, and that is our children. I hear the president-elect talking terms of better education and et cetera. These folks have no intention of better educating the sons and daughters and the children of the African American. In closing, we need to understand that we are in a difficult situation. We are at a very dangerous point in time in regards to our relationship and our ability to survive what is an extremely comprehensive, complex, and very clever plan for the demise of the African American race. May God continue to keep his hand upon the shoulders of the sons and daughters of the African. And God help us if we are not vigilant with regards to what our future is, if we have any future in the United States of America. Stay vigilant, my friends, because the neo-Nazis are at the door. They're at the gates. It's like that movie that talked in terms of those who were at the gates to bring about the destruction and the demise of a people. God bless you, Black America. Stay strong, stay vigilant. I'm Ron Edwards. This is the Don and Ron Program. Good evening.